Radio Prague News.
Czech President Miloš Zeman expects former finance minister and caretaker Prime Minister Jiří Rusnok to be the next governor of the Czech National Bank. The BIS counterintelligence service has recently uncovered three Russian spies operating in Prague, the weekly Respekt has reported, and a fire in a disused warehouse at Prague's district of Malešice killed two people on Thursday. Czech President Miloš Zeman has said he will in all likelihood nominate former finance minister and caretaker Prime Minister Jiří Rusnok to be governor of the Czech National Bank when incumbent Miroslav Singer steps down. Zeman made the comments in an interview with the Czech daily Mladá fronta dnes. Singer's mandate finishes in 1 year. Rusnok was Zeman's first appointment to the Czech Central Bank when he was placed on the board in March last year. The president has previously said he wants a new governor who will reverse the current low crown policy and will back early Czech adoption of the euro. The BIS counterintelligence service has recently uncovered three Russian spies operating in Prague, the weekly Respekt reported on Thursday, citing official sources. One of the men was allegedly an employee of the Russian embassy in Prague. The Czech authorities have not expelled them to avoid escalating tension, but they didn't renew their visas and resident permits. According to Respekt, Moscow retaliated against the Czech Republic by denying two Czech diplomats visa renewal and access to the country. President Miloš Zeman on Thursday appointed Robert Pelikán Minister of Justice. The ANO candidate, who served as first deputy, replaces Helena Válková, who resigned several weeks ago after coming under pressure to quit from her own party. She was criticized for not being able to fulfill the government's legislative plan on time, as well as a poor personnel policy. A fire in a disused warehouse at Prague's district of Malešice killed two people on Thursday, a spokeswoman for Prague Fire Service told the Czech news agency. The fire was signalled soon after midnight and firemen managed to evacuate seven people out of the object. Two bodies were found later after the fire was extinguished. The cause of the fire is being investigated. According to the police, it was probably caused by negligence, but they didn't rule out the possibility that it was set on intentionally. The ramp of a quad chairlift in the country's biggest skiing centre in Špindlerův Mlýn in the Krkonoše Mountains collapsed on Thursday. No one was hurt in the incident since the chairlift operators noticed cracking sounds coming from the building where the ramp was located and managed to evacuate people from the site before it collapsed. The operation of the chairlift has been suspended and the cause of the accident is being investigated. Czech Gabriela Soukalová took the silver medal in the World Championship 15-kilometer biathlon event at Kontiolahti in Finland. Soukalová had appeared destined for gold but was beaten by just over 23 seconds by Russia's Yekaterina Jurlova. She recorded a perfect score with the rifle compared with Soukalová's one-minute penalty. The second place is still an achievement for the Czech, who has taken most of her recent medals in relay events. Soukalová has been feeling slightly ill before the event and said she did not expect to be on the winner's podium at all. I'm Ruth Franíková and that's the end of the news.
You are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, with me, Daniela Lazarová. Coming up in today's program, President Zeman marks 2 years in office and the crown drops to a 10-year low against the dollar. Later on, Korea's esports, the liar who legitimized the Iraq war, and hip-hop seniors, just some of the subjects explored at this year's One World Documentary Festival, which has just ended in Prague. All that coming up, so please stay with us. President Miloš Zeman is marking 2 years in office as the country's first ever directly elected head of state. His first years in office have been marked by a succession of scandals, a slump in popularity, and negative publicity in the media at home and abroad. I asked the head of the STEM polling agency, Jan Hartl, about the president's performance, his influence on Czech politics, and his style of leadership.
At the beginning of his presidential term, he seemed, or he appeared not to be that much controversial as some commentators expected. And later on, he was appealing more or less to people with lower status, with his way of speech, addressing groups of lower education, and he seemed to get support of people who are generally dissatisfied with the development in the Czech Republic. And if his appeal goes to really lower or marginal strata of the population, it is a problem.
Would you say that he has been overstepping his mandate under the Constitution?
That was the commentary of majority of the press, that he tries to get much more competencies than it would be assumed by his position. And his substantiation for that was that he is the first directly elected president, and although officially his mandate is not any stronger, in fact it is, and he just tried to test the political scene, how much he can afford.
He's become quite aggressive in his attitude to the media. Is this a sign of growing uncertainty in his own position, his own strength?
I would say it is not, because his aggressive attitude towards media is a long-term phenomenon. In a way, I would say it's not very tactical. I would say that's even stupid. And it's a phenomenon which is quite common on our political scene. It seems that majority of Czech politicians do not understand that media is a part or a very important part of politics, and politicians, and namely Miloš Zeman, need support of the media, and he's making the media very upset. And when they can, I mean media, they just take the revenge and are quite coordinated in anti-presidential campaign.
When the president, when Mr. Zeman took office, he said he wanted to unite the country. Has he managed to do that, or is he dividing it, as so many people say?
His role should be to search for consensus in the society, and the opposite is the true. It's undoubtful that he's very controversial, and that he's dividing the country. Perhaps he's even polarizing some of the groups, and this is clearly the biggest problem of his presidency.
Many accuse him of damaging the country's reputation abroad. Do you think he is doing that?
His political style is somewhat strange, and it does not correspond to general expectations. And talking to people abroad, it seems that his position is at least perceived as strange, and it's for certain that he's not helping his country too much, as was the case with Václav Havel.
Do you think that he is aware of the mistakes, some of the mistakes that he has made, and do you think he's learning from those mistakes?
I think he's aware of the mistakes, and I think he's not learning. He's just enjoying his individual role. It's he's a lonely player in this respect.
Jan Hartl, head of the STEM polling agency, commenting on President Zeman's first 2 years in office. And we move on now. The Czech crown has slumped to more than 10-year lows against the US dollar, and the impact could go a lot wider than just two-way trade with the world's biggest economy, with the ripples reaching Asia and Latin America. Chris Johnston reports.
As the saying goes, it's not always what you know, but who you know. And for some currencies, especially those of small export-oriented European countries, the saying could be changed to read, it's not what you are, but who you're linked with. So when the crown plunged Wednesday to a near 11-year low of around 26 crowns against the US dollar, the main cause could be seen in the Czech currency's links with the euro. To put it bluntly, the Czech crown has been dragged down alongside the euro during the single European currency's recent plunge to near parity against the dollar. The euro has lost around 17% of its value against the dollar since the start of the year, and the crown has not been that far behind, with a 13.8% decline. Although the Czech Republic is clearly outside the eurozone, Germany and its weaker euro associates still account for the overwhelming amount of Czech bilateral trade. And while the crown is not explicitly pegged to the euro, the Czech National Bank's low crown policy and target rate of 27 crowns or lower against the euro means that the Czech Central Bank is taking its lead from euro developments. So what does the relatively high dollar mean in practice? To most ordinary people, it could mean that petrol prices will be higher than otherwise, as oil payments are made in dollars. Foreign holidays might also be more expensive as well. Aviation fuel is also priced in dollars. Some Czech companies with a substantial proportion of their revenues in dollars, such as the Czech-based global software security and antivirus company Avast, or CME, the commercial television group which owns Czech broadcaster TV Nova, will also suffer as a result. Most Czech companies, though, will not benefit that much from a weak dollar. Czech trade with the US is surprisingly small, given the fact that it's still the world's biggest economy. Eurobank economist Jan Bureš pointed out some other possible impacts.
I believe that looking at the inflation, it should have only minor impact in the fields such as IT imports, IT equipment. Parts of the electronics can be influenced as well, but it should not be a major impact on the import prices. Beside that, I believe indirect impact of the weak koruna towards the US dollar can be felt via the weakening of the Czech koruna towards some of the Asian currencies that are more or less linked to the development of the US dollar. This can have impact maybe slightly bigger because Asia is becoming a bigger and bigger trading partner for the Czech Republic.
Bureš says the worst damage to the crown has already been done, but he does not expect the strong dollar to weaken anytime soon.
Chris Johnston with that report. A reminder that you're with Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. After over 250 screenings, the 17th One World International Festival of Human Rights Documentaries has just ended here in the Czech capital. Ian Willoughby speaks to a number of filmmakers who presented their work at the annual event in this week's edition of Panorama.
There were loud cheers as the curtain fell on the 17th One World in Prague on Wednesday night. This year's edition of the festival brought over 110 films from nearly five dozen countries to the Czech capital, along with dozens of guest speakers, including directors, producers and protagonists.
Prisoners in the Gohartasht establishment spread the news of the arrival of the mysterious death commission.
Among the prize winners was Those Who Said No, which documents the Iran Tribunal in The Hague and features stirring testimony from former political prisoner Iray Mezdagi, one of the tribunal's initiators. He was at the ceremony to receive One World's Right to Know Award, selected by the Václav Havel jury.
It's a great honor for me to be here in Prague, especially winning the award of Václav Havel. You see, I was in prison, as I said in the ceremony, that I was in prison when Czechoslovakia was free. Of course, now I'm here in Prague. In 1984, I was in a box, which they call it a grave. I was blindfolded all the time, days, weeks, and months. Then the jailer one day came to me and said that this, he was joking at me, that the spring of Prague is coming. You see, I'm here in Prague in the spring. Of course, it has its meaning for me, special meaning. I'm very happy to be here. I'm very happy to have the award of this festival.
While One World is focused on human rights, the festival often interprets that term broadly. Indeed, it sometimes feels like a festival of human documentaries. Take, for instance, State of Play, which explores South Korea's e-sports, competitive video gaming that can turn top players into national stars with big earnings. The slick and compelling film follows three StarCraft players, pro, semi-pro and amateur, as it maps a fascinating world that has a huge amount in common with real-world sport. State of Play was made by Belgian director Steven Doet.
I've always been a gamer myself, so I've always been very interested in video games and the whole, let's say, the whole art and industry around it. And what I did find at the time that mainstream media was making quite a bit of reports about gaming, but it was always in a very sensational way, especially with the phenomenon of esports in Korea. I mean, usually they would go in there, they would shoot for a few days, they would film the gamers in their team house, and then when the report came out, they would basically talk about how many hours they play and how much money they make. And they would never really look for the background why this phenomenon existed in Korea and why it's so important for these kids.
Did you have to convince them, the protagonists and their parents, that you had different intentions than the mainstream media?
Yes, and that was, of course, the big challenge with this type of film. I mean, when you follow someone for 2 to 3 years, especially in the beginning, you take a lot of energy to convince them of your good intentions. I mean, from the beginning, we always made clear that we were not going to glamorize it, but we were also not going to criticize it for no reason. So yeah, I think even with our main character, it took us 1 year before he finally trusted us and realized what we were there to do.
These esports in which gamers play computer games and become like sports stars, are they specific to South Korea?
It used to be for a very long time. When I started in 2009, you had a very small scene in the United States and also in Europe, but it was not an industry as much as it was over there. And that has a lot to do with the fact that South Korea has invested a lot of money in IT and high-speed broadband internet already in the 90s. So game consoles like PlayStation and Nintendo, all those things, they've never really been very big in South Korea. It's always been a very PC-based gaming culture. And I think that's how it kind of evolved. But now it's all over the world. I mean, you've got big tournaments in the States, you've got big tournaments in Europe. Sweden is a very big country now. So that has definitely changed in the last 3-4 years.
I was fascinated that their kind of tool or their instrument is a keyboard, that they carry their keyboard with them in a sports bag.
Yeah, that's one of those things that, especially in the beginning, you notice, and it gives you a bit of a laugh because, you know, you see they have the typical bags that maybe a tennis player would put their racket in, and they put their keyboard and their mouse in it. And but at the end, yeah, it all makes sense, no? I mean, it's the most important thing you need to play the game. So they make sure that there's definitely not going to be any problems with that, that the keys all function properly.
Gaming is a huge industry. You often hear today that it's bigger than Hollywood. Does that mean you have an automatic huge potential audience for your film?
There is definitely a huge potential online audience. And we've noticed that as well in our strategy of distributing the film, is that we've always focused very much on getting the film on online platforms, simply because, you know, when you're a gamer, you also like to see movies about people gaming and about the stars that you admire. And, you know, most of these people are in front of the computer. They don't really, they're not the regular festival goer that you see here at One World, you know, the people interested in documentaries and social themes. Their way of consuming media is on the computer. So that's definitely a big audience for us, yeah.
His lies were leading the world into a war in Iraq.
This is Purple.
Much of War of Lies is given over to the testimony of Rafid Ahmad Anwar al-Janabi, who defected from Iraq in 1999. A diehard opponent of Saddam Hussein, The chemical engineer provided the German intelligence service with false information that the dictator could produce weapons of mass destruction, information that after 9/11 was used by the US to justify invading the country. Al-Janabi, codenamed Curveball, later achieved international ignominy when his identity was revealed in 2007. War of Lies German director Matthias Bittner explains how the US fell for his fabrications.
They were seeking over so long for evidence that there is weapons of mass destruction, and they were, the UN and UNMOFIC and ANSCOM were looking for the evidence that there is still production facilities that are producing agents. And now they had a guy who was from the inner circle.
Or claimed to be.
Yeah, he really was from the inner circle. So he really worked there, but he wasn't a high-ranking guy. He was a bad student. And but he was from that circle. That's why he was so interesting.
What was his motivation in speaking to you, do you think?
After his picture was and his name was published, and he was the go-chief of all this war, that he was the only one being responsible, I think he started to fight back by putting himself in the position of I was the one who helped toppling the regime. I think he made a mistake with that because he didn't calculate how the power of media. They made him the bad guy. With us, it was different because we weren't journalists. This is my graduation project. At that time, I was a student, and I introduced myself to him as a student. I think he just had the feeling that there is some different interest in his story. So we didn't include in the film any other voices of someone. It's just his point of view, and I think it's important just to hear his point of view. If it's right or wrong, if he's telling lies or not, I think it doesn't matter that... It's more important to learn something about the character, the man itself, the human being that has to cope with the consequences of a lie that helped to destroy a country and to kill people, his own people.
His codename was Curveball. Did he throw you any curveballs as a protagonist?
Yeah, you know, I had the feeling sometimes that he's playing the same game or behaving and acting sometimes in the same way that he did with the intelligence. Sometimes I really had the feeling that this is all a game of wrong and right information, bits and pieces of you have to put together like in a puzzle. Yeah, he was quite a character. He was not easy to handle. On the other hand, you have to see it in a different way because... None of us really had the experience of living under a regime 30 years. You don't know what it is to live like that. We are living in a Western world, enjoying a beautiful lifestyle, and he was living under brutality. And then he came out of Iraq, and he found himself in another prison when he was 10 years surrounded by intelligence agencies. So this... guy might have lost some trust, lost some trust in people itself, so in life itself.
Our next performers range in age from 66 to 94 years old. Please welcome Hip Hopperation.
One of the biggest crowd pleasers at this year's One World was Hip Hopperation. It follows a group of 24 vibrant seniors from New Zealand, average age 80. Under the name Hip Hopperation Crew, as so many have had hip replacements, they learn some bustin' dance moves and make it all the way to the glitzy World Hip Hop Championships in Las Vegas, where they go down a storm. Director Bryn Evans said there were particular challenges of working with such elderly subjects.
Probably the key issue to overcome was, for a lot of them, they hadn't had a camera ever around them. And I think after probably about 2 or 3 days, a lot of them were starting to come up and go, well, when are we going to see this on the news? when can I start telling my family? And it was quite difficult to overcome that issue of, look, we're going to be following this story for 12 months. It may not be in theatres for another 2 years. You know, and that's quite a difficult concept for anyone who isn't used to having cameras around.
Also, who's so old, they may not live to see the premiere of the film?
That is entirely, you know, true. I mean, one of the wonderful things, especially in this case, was when we had the screening for the crew, everyone was still there to experience it. And thankfully, you know, even to this day, so many years on now since we started, you know, all of those key characters are still with us and they're still dancing and the group is still performing. So I know in my own mind, because editing takes a long time, you know, we were sort of 6 months working through the story, and one of the things in the back of your mind is that you don't want anyone not to see this film. It's you know, it became so important.
I know the film has been very successful in New Zealand. You've won awards. How has it gone down with the public?
The film was made for audiences. I come from a very strong human rights background. This story is very different to the type of story, the type of issue-based story that I'd normally be attracted to. So one of my main goals when we started out was to make a human rights story that connected to a general audience. That is our job as filmmakers. It has been extraordinarily successful with audiences. I know in the States we've been in several festivals there now, and surprisingly too, the European audiences have really gravitated towards it as well. So, you know, I couldn't be happier.
Do people cheer during the very big moments?
Yeah, of course. You can't help but cheer. It's a feel-good film, you know. And the lovely thing about it is that it's a story about this incredible group of individuals that come together. You know, it's not, you know, we're not telling a story about them. They're telling us their story and their journey. So I think audiences do get caught up in their journey, and they cheer and they cry. And it's, for me, it's incredibly rewarding. Yeah.
Hip Operation Director Bryn Evans. After coming to an end in Prague, this year's One World Festival of Human Rights Documentaries is now moving on in reduced form to more than 30 other Czech cities and towns.
And that edition of Panorama with Ian Willoughby has brought us to the end of today's programme from Prague. You'll find us online at radio.cz. This is Danielle Lazarová saying thanks for listening and take care.